From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, comic Chris Rock. He started his career on Saturday Night Live and more recently was the presidential campaign correspondent for Politically Incorrect. And you can describe a lot of his humor as politically incorrect. His own late-night variety show premieres tomorrow on HBO. Also, we'll talk with Louis Messiah about his new documentary on W.E.B. Du Bois, which will be shown tomorrow on many public TV stations. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tries to figure out what postmodern really means. And Milo Miles looks at the singing career of Jesse Stone. As chief music arranger at Atlantic Records, he helped shape rock and roll. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Republicans are underwhelmed by President Clinton's new budget. It was sent to Capitol Hill this morning, a $1.7 trillion spending plan designed to erase the federal deficit in 5 years. Senate Budget Committee Chairman Pete Domenici says it's not the bold step he had hoped for. House Budget Chairman John Kasich says the president calls for ending big government but then offers new programs. Larry Haas of the Office of Management and Budget is confident of the figures.
We're not just looking to save. We're looking to do other things. We're looking to cut taxes. We're looking to invest. We're looking to repair some of the provisions of last year's welfare bill that we don't think had anything to do with welfare reform and that we thought were harsh and unnecessary cuts directed mostly at legal immigrants and nutrition programs.
A top Pentagon official predicts rough going for the president's proposed $248 billion defense budget. It contains $2 billion for military operations in Bosnia, and he says some lawmakers are still upset that they were not consulted before the U.S. commitment in the Balkans was extended. An attorney for assisted suicide supporter Dr. Jack Kevorkian is hinting his client was involved in the recent deaths of two women. Attorney Jeffrey Feiger told the Detroit News it was obvious who was involved in the cases. The bodies of a 79-year-old California woman and a 42-year-old New Jersey woman were discovered yesterday at separate locations in suburban Detroit. Kevorkian's been free on bond since being charged in the August death of a Michigan woman. A condition of the bond is that he not attend another death. Prosecutors say Feiger's statement alone is not enough for them to revoke the bond. A United Auto Workers Union strike against seat maker Johnson Controls may result in the shutdown of two Ford Motor Company truck plants as early as today. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The strike by UAW members at Johnson Controls plants in Plymouth, Michigan and Oberlin, Ohio is now 10 days old. Initially, Johnson officials said they could continue to produce seats used in Ford's Expedition Sport Utility Vehicle and the Econoline van using replacement workers. But Ford, not wanting to damage its own positive relationship with the UAW, said it would not accept any seats until the strike is settled. But that position means seat shortages may force Ford to halt production at the Michigan truck plant and at the Lorain assembly plant in Ohio. That means customers waiting for the hot-selling vehicles will have to wait even longer. The labor dispute is over wages. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A mediator in the hostage crisis in Peru says the leftist rebels and the government both must ease their positions before talks can begin. Archbishop Juan Luis Cipriani says improving attitudes would help the situation in Lima. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 6.5 points at 6,753. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the number of German unemployed has risen to a post-World War II record high. Last month, German unemployment rose by 450,000 people, a massive number. NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
About 4.37 million German workers are unemployed. That's about 12.2% of the workforce. These numbers are not seasonally adjusted. The increase is being blamed partly on a cold winter that prohibited construction. The German finance minister urged economic reforms. Germany's wages are among the highest in the world, and jobs are being lost to countries with cheaper workforces. Union leaders say the high German unemployment rate threatens social stability. The job loss was also seen as a result of German businesses trying to make themselves leaner to compete in the European Union. The new figures are likely to put pressure on German Chancellor Helmut Kohl to speed up his plan to lower taxes in order to stimulate growth and to reform the pension system, which is costing the government more than it says it can afford. In Berlin, I'm Edward Lipson reporting.
Chrysler says a majority of more than 4 million Chrysler minivan owners still have not had their rear latches replaced. The automaker filed a report with federal safety officials today. It offered to replace the potentially defective latches 15 months ago, but just 47% of the owners have come in for the work. The Center for Auto Safety says the reason for the lack of response is that it is a service campaign rather than an official recall. The affected vans are Chrysler Town & Country, Dodge Caravan, or Plymouth Voyager. They were sold between 1984 and 1995. At least 37 people have been killed in accidents after being thrown from the minivans when the rear liftgate latches gave way. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 6.5 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
Fresh Air support comes from William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of Chris Rock's comedy is so politically incorrect that political and social commentators have weighed in with their opinions on it. Rock appeared regularly on the program Politically Incorrect during the presidential campaign as the show's campaign correspondent. Tomorrow he launches his own late-night variety show on HBO. Each show will open with a topical monologue, followed by an interview, comedy sketches, and a performance by a guest musician. Chris Rock got his start on Saturday Night Live and worked on In Living Color. He co-wrote and co-starred in the film CB4, a satire of the rap world, and he appeared in the films Beverly Hills Cop 2, Panther, and New Jack City. He has a comedy album coming out soon called Bring the Pain. I asked him what got the biggest response when he was on the campaign trail for Politically Incorrect.
There's a woman, or a Republican, I forget her name, some woman that was really ripping. The woman basically said that Bill Clinton was not qualified to be president because he was from Arkansas. And I thought, you know, who the hell is this lady? So I said, ma'am, with all due respect, you're the meanest bitch I've ever heard. And that got, you know. So I said that, and that pretty much got the biggest response. Even when I did Charlie Rose, he showed the clip. Like, this has been haunting me, following me for a while now.
So would you have...
And when I was in New Hampshire, I'd mentioned that it was hard for me to find any hair care products. That
right.
Seemed to get a big laugh.
Would you have said that to the woman if you had to do it over again?
If I had to do it over again, I don't know. You know, I guess not. You know, when you're a comedian, it's like, especially me, I feel like the Hulk sometimes. I don't even know what I'm doing. Then when I'm not performing, I check to see if anybody got hurt. So if I knew what was going to happen, yeah, I probably wouldn't. But I never know what's going to happen.
You have a comedy record coming out.
Yes, I do.
That has a lot of the same material as your HBO special from a few months ago, which is called Bring the Pain.
Bring the Pain.
Great title.
Thank you.
Probably the most controversial part as part of this, cutting right to the chase, is what you describe as the civil war between black people. In fact, let me play an excerpt of this sketch.
Oh, boy.
Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. There's some shit going on with black people right now. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people and there's niggas. The niggas have got to go. Every time black people want to have a good time, ignorant ass niggas up. Can't do shit. Can't do nothing. Can't keep a disco open more than 3 weeks. Grand opening, grand closing. Can't go to a movie the first week it come out. Why? Because niggas are shooting at the screen.
What is the range of reaction, Chris Rock, that you've gotten to this sketch?
Wow, you know what's weird?
What?
It's been nothing but positive reaction. This whole special, the only negative reaction I've ever gotten from this special, and I'm not jumping on a bandwagon here trying to get, you know, famous, is Bill Cosby.
What did he say?
Well, he didn't say anything. He just wanted his, in the beginning of the special, I have a bunch of old comedy album covers flashing. And these are just guys I grew up with and I really loved. And it's Bill Cosby and it's Woody Allen and it's Flip Wilson and Dick Gregory and Pygmy Markham and Eddie and Pryor. And they're just like my heroes. And he wanted his album removed, so I guess he didn't like the special. But other than that, it's been nothing but good reaction.
Were you thinking about particular experiences you had or particular people you know when you wrote this?
Boy, again, it's like the Hulk syndrome. It's like, I'm not really thinking about anything. I'm just interpreting. This is like, you know, everything I said in that routine, my mother said, my father said, I heard in barbershops. It's not like I'm, you know, it's not like I invented anything, you know.
Help me
this
out.
This has been, you know, these views have been out there forever. Just nobody said it.
You know, I couldn't help but wonder, listening to it, if a white comic said exactly the same thing you said, it would have a completely different meaning, I think.
Yes, it would. Why would a white comic want to say what I said? Why would that ever be, in what context would that ever be necessary?
So what's the difference between you saying it and a white comic saying it?
I can say it. What's the difference between someone calling your kid an idiot and you calling your kid an idiot? It's a big difference. It's a right. Huge difference.
Your
kid knows what you mean when you say it. Your kid knows you just mean he's messing up. When somebody else says it, boy, that's mean.
Did you go through a radical black consciousness period when you were in your teens?
No. No, you know, I didn't go through I was in my teens. That's like the 80s. So it's not exactly the most conscious decade or time. You know, I was bused to school as a kid.
Mm-hmm. From where to where?
From Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn to Garrison Beach, Brooklyn, and to Bensonhurst. And, you know, I was getting called nigger since I was like in the second grade. So I never, I was always in tune with my blackness, you know, from the time I was, you know, in the second grade.
Weren't there a lot of other people from your neighborhood who got bused to Bensonhurst?
There was like a contingent, about like five of us.
Five, that's all?
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, from my, you know, when I say the neighborhood, I'm just talking about like a block, like a two block radius. You know, when you grow up like in a bad neighborhood, there's not a lot of venturing out. So my neighborhood was like two blocks to me. Then the rest of the neighborhood, I didn't go anywhere because anything could happen. My mother wasn't having it.
So how many African-American students would you say there were in the schools that you got busted?
In the schools, okay. I was like the only black kid in my grade a couple of times.
Wow, uh-huh.
I was the only black boy. And then there were like two black girls, three black girls. For like most of my grade school. And the girls had each other. I was kind of like by myself. And I would have, you know, it's weird. Even though I would get, you know, beat up and, you know, all that other stuff. Of course, my best friend would end up being white in that same environment. Then he'd get beat up for being my friend. It's a weird circle of events.
So you think that contributed to your being a comedian because you were so alienated?
Yeah, I was alienated. And I had nothing else to do. You know, I always loved comedy. You know, I had nothing to fall back on. I have no real skills. You know, if I picked up a paper right now and, you know, went through the want ads, there's nothing I could get that would pay me more than minimum wage. So I loved comedy, got into it, was a little twisted. You know, my schooling had twisted me somewhat. And it really helped me out. I mean, I would say probably today, most black people, not most black people, but a lot of black people, you don't really experience racism hands-on. You always, like my brothers who didn't get bused to school, like they experience the effects of racism, you know, living in a bad neighborhood, you can't get the cab, bad jobs, all that stuff. But very few people get that, especially in the North, that, hey, nigga, that in your face every day. There's not a lot of guys my age that have been through what I've been through.
My guest is comic Chris Rock. His new variety show premieres tomorrow night on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Chris Rock. How did you get your first comedy break?
How did I get my first comedy break? What's the first one? I guess I was discovered, I hate to say this, not that it's a bad thing, it just leads to other questions. I was discovered by Eddie Murphy at the comic strip in New York about 8 years ago now. And, he saw my act, liked what I was doing, and put me in this HBO special called the Uptown Comedy Express. It was on me, Robert Townsend, Arsenio Hall, Marsha Warfield, and Barry Sobel. And this it aired about eight years ago.
Must have been pretty exciting for you because Eddie Murphy was one of the people you really wanted to emulate.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy was an idol of mine. I wouldn't say... I never really wanted to emulate his work, per se. Like, I'd love his work. I just always wanted to do some other thing. I idolized him as a personality, more so than anything else. Like, wow, it's a young guy doing it. More so than the actual art part of it. But, it's, if I had to pattern myself after anybody... It's more of a Sam Kinison thing. It's like my comedic pattern. Like, really, I try to be Sam Kinison comedically.
What qualities of his? That in-your-face quality?
That in-your-face shock. Things that are said every day but never said on stage quality.
Give me an example.
When Sam was funny, just that whole go to where the food is bit. I don't know. I just remember Sam Kinison when I was coming up was like the only guy that sounded new. Everybody else was kind of doing different versions of other guys. Kinison was like totally new. I mean, even Eddie did Pryor. Pryor kind of did Cosby. And, Jerry Seinfeld did Robert Klein. Everybody kind of did somebody. And Sam, I don't know anybody that sounds like Sam Kinison.
So what's an example of something that you'd say on stage that you think people would be afraid to say off stage?
What's an example? That whole black people versus niggers bit. The whole, anything in my, most of the stuff in my special probably wouldn't, guys wouldn't say. A lot of stuff.
I want to ask you about a couple other influences of yours. Pigmeat Markham, what does he mean to you?
Just the timing, just the... I wasn't a huge Pigmeat Markham fan, but I wanted to put him on my album, on my special. I talked to a lot of... it's weird. I'm 30, but I'm like an elder statesman with the young black comics. So I'm always trying to get guys to listen to other guys besides Pryor and Eddie. So I just put Pig Meek and I put Dick Gregory up there just so guys can see that and go, oh, okay, maybe I should get that album. Maybe I should check this guy out.
Woody Allen, where does he figure in?
Wait, now that I'm older... Woody Allen's my favorite guy right now. Woody Allen, the only American genius we have. Just by far the best writer, the best comedian, best director. I have an insane respect for Woody Allen. I wish I could just like have lunch with the guy one day. I don't even have to be. I wish he could just let me sit at the other table and let me overhear his conversation. That would be enough for me.
When did he start to interest you?
When did he start to interest me? Even as a kid. See, that's like one of the nerd things. Like all my other friends are like, you know, in the Animal House or Blazing Saddles. And I think Take the Money and Run's the best thing ever. I'm watching Sleeper on the 4:30 movie. Annie Hall. I mean, you know, I was that, you know, I'm the black kid who's dying to see Annie Hall. I was a weird kid. It's an odd chap.
Now, I have a question about your voice. Your voice in your onstage performances, in when you're doing comedy, is much deeper, louder, and rougher than your voice in conversation, which is higher and lighter.
Right.
Almost sweeter, if I could use that word.
Oh, thanks.
And I almost feel like, are you not comfortable with that voice on stage? Do you feel like you need a harder-edged voice to do your comedy?
Well, you know, it's the money's on the line. It's like people are paying $25. They want a performance. They don't want me. They want me to be better than me. I got to look better than me. I got to be taller, louder, funny. I have to be more. So, I mean, when you're on stage, it's kind of like being a woman, you know? It's like, put on the makeup, do the hair. You know, nobody wants me. They want Chris Rock. I'm just Chris.
so you got to put on a personality on stage.
Well, I got to be bigger than I normally am. I mean, at the same token, I couldn't walk through life acting the way I act on stage.
Well, right, without getting hit a lot, probably.
Right, exactly.
No, I meant to ask you, did you go to the Million Man March? You talk about it a little bit in your routine. Were you there?
You know what? I didn't go.
How come?
I should have went.
Did you think about it? Was it a decision to go or not to go?
Now, you know, first of all, the decision, I mean, probably the main reason I didn't go because I'm famous and I just...
Right.
I
don't really like being in big crowds when you're famous.
I really don't feel like being in big crowds.
Yeah. Look, there's like, Chris Rock.
Yeah, but there are a lot of other famous people that are more famous than me. But I don't know. I support the Million Man March and all it stood for. The whole repenting thing was like a little weird to me. Because it was kind of the whole nation, a day of, the day of?
Atoning?
Of Day of Atoning. It was kind of, in a sense, you're saying everybody's messed up. The whole race needs to atone. It's like, hey, and at the end they had this big, everybody, you know, raise one hand. I will never hit a woman. I will never steal. I won't take drugs. I haven't done any of those things. And at the same time, I don't think I'm a Superman. I don't think I should be exalted for it. So I don't know. I felt out of, you know, it was just a weird day for me.
Actually, you have something related to that that's very funny in your performance where you talk about people who brag, I'm so great, I've never hit a woman, or...
Yeah.
So I mean, great, and I take care of my child, and you say, yeah, you're supposed to. I mean, that's just a given.
Yeah, it's just, a bunch of guys, I'm going to take care of my kids. Okay, that's what you need. I don't have any kids. I don't have any kids out of wedlock. I don't have any children. I don't know. Million Man March was a weird day for me. It was a weird day because I was watching it on TV actually wishing I was there. But at the same time, there were parts of it that I knew why I wasn't there, so.
I have one last question for you. It might be...
Really?
Yeah, what might seem strange to you. What, did being really skinny, do you think, affect who you became and how people thought of you? Or, you know, how you see yourself as a comic? Were you kind of scrawny as a kid?
I'm scrawny now as a man. totally. Being skinny has affected every aspect of my life. Every decision I make, everything I put on. Put it this way. Look at my stand-up. My stand-up, I have twice as many... I always say comedy, stand-up comedy and boxing are pretty much the same. You know, boxing is to sports what stand-up is to entertainment because it's just a guy out there by himself. And I perform like a skinny boxer where I don't have the ability to knock you out. So you take my hour special and anybody else's hour special. I probably have twice as many jokes compact in it. Because my size has me so insecure, I'm always working twice as hard. So, yeah, being skinny has totally affected me and totally, totally, totally weirded me out.
But speaking of boxing,
did
people fight with you a lot when you were young and take advantage of your size?
Totally, totally. And the only reason they don't do it now is because I'm me.
Right, you're famous.
That's the only reason.
Did you learn to fight?
When you're as small as I am, it doesn't really matter.
Try martial arts or anything?
Martial arts. Some big guy will just grab you and throw you down. What's the point?
Did you try to cripple your opponent with comedy?
I've just, stayed out of environments and situations where fights may occur. No drinking. Like, I don't drink because I can't fight. Wherever there's alcohol served, there's a bouncer because people get out of hand. So I can't. Too little to be around guys that get out of hand. So I can't drink. Poor, woe is me. I'm sure Woody and Spike think the same.
Right, right. Well, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, you can have them on your show and talk about it. A little self-help.
Yeah. That's why I love Spike, Brooklyn and Skinny.
Well, Chris Rock, I wish you really good luck with your new show.
Thank you.
And thanks a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, no problem.
Chris Rock's new variety show premieres tomorrow night on HBO. Here's more from his forthcoming CD, Bring the Pain. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Mary and Beth! At the Mary and Beth bar, how did he get a ticket? It was a damn positive ticket. How did he get it, man? Mary and Beth at the Million Man bar. You know what that means? That means that even in our finest hour, we had a crackhead on stage. Man, fool if you want. You know I'm right. How the hell Mary Barry get his job back? Smoke crack got his job back. How the hell that happened? I mean, if you get caught smoking crack at McDonald's, you can't get your job back. Right. They're not gonna trust you around the Happy Meals. They'll send your ass to Hardee's. Smoke crack got his job, but all I wanna know, who ran against him that they lost? Who was so bad they lost to a crackhead? What was their campaign like? What was they on heroin?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Louis Messiah about his documentary on W.E.B. Du Bois, which airs tomorrow on many public TV stations. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tries to figure out where modernism ends and postmodernism begins. And Milo Miles reviews a new collection by singer Jesse Stone. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the end of the millennium draws near, we keep hearing a lot about postmodern, or just POMO, a label that seems to apply to everything from architecture to birthday parties. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the phrase and wants to know, when did modernism end and how can we tell?
We used to know what modernism was, or at least when it was. It has to do with Picasso and Stravinsky and Mies van der Rohe and Virginia Woolf. But at some point since then, they started to roll the period backwards. People began saying that modernism started 70 years earlier with Flaubert and Bentham, or they put it back with Diderot and Condorcet in the 18th century, which, by the way, has now itself been redefined so that it begins around 1660. Or earlier still. A couple of years ago, people stopped talking about the Renaissance and started calling it the early modern period. It's hard to tell where it's all going to end, or I suppose I should say, where it's all going to begin. I asked a medievalist friend, okay, so who's the last pre-modern, Chaucer? Chaucer, she said, oh no, a remarkably modern figure. All right, I said, well, how about William the Conqueror? Well, yeah, I guess, she said, at least before he crossed the channel. I suspect that one reason for this period creep is that the longer the modern age is, the greater the crash it makes when it goes down. Depending on where they're coming from, critics and philosophers locate the symbolic end of the modernist period at different moments: the appearance of Philip Johnson's AT&T building in New York, the publication of Roland Barthes' SZ, the first Steve Martin album, the one where he's wearing an arrow on his head. There was an article in the New Yorker recently that said that modernism ended with the Tawana Brawley case. Whatever the date, though, everybody seems certain that modernity is a thing of the past, along with all its fellow travelers. The narrative is unraveled, the author is dead, the Enlightenment project is toast, and history is history. Of course, I suppose people in every age like to think of themselves as living a millennial moment. We stand on the high peak between the ages, is how Marinetti put it 75 years ago, and you can find people who proclaim more or less the same thing in every period going back to Hesiod. Still, it isn't every generation that gets to live at the brink of an honest-to-God millennium. And I don't know that any other age has thought of the zeitgeist in such an exclusively retrospective way. People don't say, from now on, only never again. Hence the passion for that suffix post. We are postmodern, posthumanist, postindustrial, postliberal, postchristian, poststructuralist, postfeminist, postcolonial. A writer in the American Scholar not long ago announced that we'd entered the age of postculturalism, and I'm sure there are plenty of other posts hovering just over the lintel. I have this image of everybody shuffling backwards toward the millennium under a banner that bears the device, been there, done that. All these names that begin with post and neo, it's as if we ran out of language all of a sudden, so there's nothing for it but to recycle the old words with prefixes tacked onto them. But that's the mark of the postmodern. As Frederick Jameson pointed out, it's all pastiche, old signs in new bottles. Portman Hotel lobbies, the Plymouth Prowler, Neo Disco, Blue Velvet, Combustible Edison. It can be a subtle business even trying to figure out what time it is. As Wired magazine explained the difference, a modernist always wore a tie with a jacket, a postmodernist throws a well-tailored jacket over a t-shirt. It was the well-tailored that struck me there. That's the great paradox of the postmodern, after all. Here's this epical shift in the basic condition of being, and you have to have an eye for a lapel even to recognize that it's taking place. Or maybe it's just a linguistic problem. Maybe people have just gotten a little confused about prefixes. You have the feeling that post doesn't really mean after anymore, the way it does in post-war, post-mortem, post-deb. Now it means something closer to once more without feeling. And when you come to think of it, we don't use the prefix pre the way we used to either. We've got pre-owned cars, pre-approved loans. They announce pre-boarding, and there are already people getting on the plane. It's as if all times are present at once, the effect that critics like to describe as the always already there. Somebody described Beck as the post-Neil Young, and I suppose you could say that Cyndi Lauper is the prima donna. But then a certain confusion about time has always been a fin de siècle condition. In the words of that eminent proto-postmodernist Charles Jenks, it's the end of the century, and things are getting complicated.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and editor of a new collection of essays called The Future of the Book. Coming up, a new documentary on W.E.B. Du Bois. This is Fresh Air. W.E.B. Du Bois was born in 1868, 5 years after the slaves in America were freed, and died on the eve of the March on Washington led by Martin Luther King. Du Bois devoted most of the 95 years of his life to the advancement of African Americans and Africans. Du Bois was the first African American to get a doctorate from Harvard, wrote what is considered the first book of urban sociology, co-founded the NAACP, and was a pioneer of Pan-Africanism. He also wrote one of the most important books in African American literature, The Souls of Black Folk. Written in 1903, it predicted that the major issue of the 20th century would be the color line. Tomorrow night, many PBS stations will show a documentary on Du Bois, directed by my guest Louis Messiah. He also worked on the Eyes on the Prize series and is a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. I asked Messiah what Du Bois meant to him before he started the film.
It's funny. I think my first memories of Du Bois came in the early 60s. I guess 6 or 7 or 5 or 6, somewhere in there. I remember hearing from my parents that Dr. Du Bois was moving to Ghana, or had moved to Ghana, which he did in 1961. And at that time, Nkrumah was the president of Ghana, was, you know, the first leader of an independent Ghana. And my father had known Nkrumah when he was at Lincoln, when Nkrumah was at Lincoln. My father was much older than Nkrumah.
Lincoln University.
Lincoln University outside of Philadelphia. And Nkrumah had sort of put a call out for black folks from around the world in the diaspora to come to help build the Ghanaian nation. And so my father had said, look, you know, here's Du Bois at age, you know, 93, moving to Ghana, you know, to sort of do this work on an Encyclopedia Africana. You know, maybe I should go as an engineer and contractor and see if I could do some work. But my mother had 3 kids at that time and really sort of hesitated to sort of uproot and move to Africa. But that was the first sort of memory I have of Du Bois. But certainly growing up, you know, Du Bois was a reference point in school. I remember reading from Souls of Black Folk. We had there was a parent at the school, Dr. Catherine Morgan, who used to bring in various writings. And I remember sort of having a discussion group on Souls of Black Folk.
Du Bois lived to 95. What are some of the parts of history that you cover just by covering him?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, for me, I mean, I grew up growing up in the 60s. You know, I have a clear notion of the 60s, you know, up until today. And in this country, as an African American, you know, there's an awareness of the time of enslavement, the time of captivity. But really, in that span of time, really the century between Reconstruction and the modern civil rights movement, that hasn't been an area that's been explored popularly. And so, looking at Du Bois, who really was active almost up until the day of his death in 1963, we have a way of looking at all the different strategies in the African-American freedom movement. So whether it's Pan-Africanism, socialism, integration, cooperative economics, Du Bois at some point in his life is sort of looking at them. Also, there are also paths that he didn't choose, that you see him as a force of opposition. I mean, in terms of nationalism, Du Bois was not a nationalist. He opposed Marcus Garvey. So by looking at him, we get to look at not only his past, but some of the other paths that we've had.
Because he lived so long, to 95, he had time to rethink certain views, and he changed his mind about a few things. What are some of the things he changed his mind about, and how did that complicate things for you doing a biographical film about him?
Well, I think it makes it much more interesting, and it also shows his intelligence in a lot of ways. I mean, as the context of the times change, because things do change over a century, which is, you know, he lived nearly a century, a thinking person reacts to that. So where early in his life, you know, he works strictly for integration, by the time of the 30s, he's beginning to see that this forced system of segregation is not something to be thrown away. I mean, not that he was for segregation, but saying that it was important for the black community to develop their economy, to develop institutions within the economy, and not to abandon them. The talented tenth notion, he writes an essay in 1903 about the talented tenth, this notion that the few people, the few percentage of African Americans who had gained an education, had gained some sort of responsibility to the broader mass, the 90% that didn't have educational access, that were not, you know, lawyers, teachers, doctors, or whatever. By the 40s, he does another essay. He actually gives a speech to a group of African-American men, the Boulé, and he sort of makes some slight revisions in that and tries to clarify it, because it seems at that point that the talented tenth is an elitist notion, which doesn't really hold that well in the 40s.
Du Bois joined the Communist Party in 1961, and that, I think, really changed the way a lot of people saw him, because he entered into what some people perceived as enemy territory. How do you think that his joining the Communist Party affected his reputation?
I would say even before his joining the Communist Party, in 1951, Dr. Du Bois was indicted for his work with what was then called the Peace Information Center, that was circulating something called the Stockholm Peace Petition. Now, 1951, we're in the middle of the Korean War. You know, the Cold War is really, you know, at its one of its first heights. And the notion of people in the Justice Department was that if you advocated peace, you were therefore anti-American. So many people involved in the peace movement, and the peace movement included a wide array of people, from church groups to, you know, women's groups, as well as to political groups. The Communist Party was involved in the peace movement at that time. So the indictment of Du Bois sort of took him away from the mainstream and the popular discourse. I would say up until 1950, without question, Du Bois was one of the best known African Americans. I would say maybe Paul Robeson and Louis Armstrong might be there. But after 51, you see his speaking engagements drying up. Du Bois relied heavily on speaking at colleges and universities, but many of these black colleges and universities were supported by state government and federal government. Major publishers, Du Bois had published 37 works over his life. Major publishers refused to publish him. His granddaughter in the film says he became persona non grata, and his books were literally taken out of libraries during that time. So as a result of that, we lose him from the popular discourse, and what we have is sort of it leaves this hole in American history.
I think W.E.B. Du Bois is better known now to intellectuals than he is as just like a popular figure, in the way that, say, Martin Luther King is known as a popular figure.
I think that's true. I mean, among intellectuals, among activists, and among artists, particularly writers, African-American writers, Du Bois' legacy is quite strong, and he is referenced very, very often. Du Bois was not a street fighter. Du Bois did not lead street marches, although in 1917 he led an anti-lynching march in New York City, but that wasn't his work. He was an intellectual, and our society, for the most part, does not honor intellectuals, and an African-American intellectual is something that, because of the sort of, you know, innate, you know, sort of racism in a lot of what goes on, is something that is not normally put out there. I mean, and I think in the last, since the 60s, with, you know, the growth in black studies, you know, we have become more comfortable with the notion that there are African-American intellectuals who can comment and on a variety of different subjects. King and Malcolm X were intellectuals, but they were also activists, and there also was footage of them in active sort of positions. That does affect a lot of the sort of popular influence.
Louis Messiah is my guest, and his new film is a biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, which will be shown on public television Friday night. There's some wonderful archival footage you have of Du Bois. What do you consider to be the prize in your archival footage?
Well, many things, I guess. In a lot of ways, making this film was really this treasure hunt, really trying to see if we could find images, photographic images, moving film footage images, as well as archival audio that would allow us to tell the story, actually the four stories in the film. And I think probably there was footage that I had gotten in Ghana. I had gone to a film festival in Burkina Faso, which is a country north of Ghana, and then traveled into Accra, and there went to the archives at Ghana. Du Bois lived the last 2 years of his life there, and there was able to find footage of his burial and some incidents in the last few years of his life. That was pretty spectacular for two reasons. One is, film really was not made for tropical climates. It was really made for the Northern Hemisphere. And one of the tragedies of that is that film archives in places where you don't have, you know, constant temperature control, where you have power failures and the air conditioning goes out, often deteriorates. The greater tragedy is that Nkrumah, when he became president of Ghana, realized the importance of film in terms of spreading really the change that was going on in Africa, and sent out camera crews to document major events happening all through Africa. So just about every single independence that occurred from 57 to, you know, the early 60s when Nkrumah was in power was documented by Ghanaian film crews. And a lot of that is deteriorated because the film is not stable. But fortunately, I found this strip of footage that had footage of Dr. Du Bois and the burial, and that meant a great deal to me.
Lou, you've lived in Philadelphia most of your life. You grew up here. You live here now. You've been gone for certain jobs and stuff in between. But one of Du Bois' famous studies was called The Philadelphia Negro. What did you learn about your home by reading that text?
Although the specifics have changed between 1896 and 1897, when Du Bois was working on The Philadelphia Negro, and now,
100 years later,
yeah. It's interesting, many of the issues, many, and some of the rationale that Du Bois had in making The Philadelphia Negro still persist. One of the reasons he was commissioned to write The Philadelphia Negro was, at that time, among certain sort of Philadelphia Brahmins, there was a sense that that there was criminality going on in poor neighborhoods and in black neighborhoods in particular. And the question was, did black people have some particular propensity to crime, which is not completely dissimilar to what people have suggested. Some folks have on the right have suggested today. So Du Bois set out to do this study. In many ways, this is the beginning of urban sociology in the United States. That is, the process of not making sociological statements based on whim or opinion, but really doing hard empirical research. What Du Bois did was to interview thousands of people living in the 7th Ward, which is a very large tract in Philadelphia, each family, asking them about income, asking them about health, asking them about occupation, asking them about pastimes. And from that data, was able to see that if people don't have jobs, then there's a higher incidence of crime, there's a higher incidence of disease. When people do have jobs, it's less and less. So he was able to show direct correlations between sort of economic, you know, well-being and some of the negatives in society. So it was instructive in those ways.
Now that you have a chance to look back on a documentary that took you years to make, the film about W.E.B. Du Bois, what would you say is the hardest part of a biographical documentary?
I think the hardest part for me of a biographical documentary is being in the making of it, being aware that film is not the person. You know, in many ways, you know, 2 hours of viewing time is not the person, and not being confused by that, realizing that what we can best do, and when I say we, I'm talking about my collaborators on the project, Tulani Davis, Tony Cade Bambara, Miri Baraka, and Wesley Brown, what we can do is sort of give some sense of someone's life and some context to the life. I think that was the context of Du Bois' time that I found most interesting. In the film, I'm not, in all honesty, I'm not terribly interested in his relationship with his mother. Maybe that's a fault, but that to me is not as interesting as what's happening to the vast majority of African Americans, what's happening in America, what's happening in the world. That, to me, is the film that I'm interested in. And Du Bois allows a lens, because he's so active, he allows a lens to look at this century of history.
Louis Messiah's documentary on W.E.B. Du Bois will be shown tomorrow night on many PBS stations. Coming up, the singing career of the man who wrote Shake, Rattle, and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Jesse Stone helped shape the sound that was to become rock and roll. As chief arranger during the early days at Atlantic Records, he guided the company toward producing a more swinging, urban sound. He wrote such hits as Money Honey and Shake, Rattle, and Roll. A new collection focuses on his own singing career. Our critic Milo Miles says it's high time we heard from the man himself.
Arkansas, they serve you coleslaw, chopped up finer than a bale of straw. When you crunch and gnaw, a bunch of coleslaw keeps you chewing like a crosscut saw. Exercise your jaw by eating coleslaw, best old goodness that you ever saw. You can break no law by wanting coleslaw. It ain't nothing but some cabbage raw. It can't be.
From the start, Jesse Stone was determined to make it in the music business. He started with fiddle and dancing dogs when he was just a teenager. In the 1930s, he became the musical mentor for the Sweethearts of Rhythm, the finest all-female big band. Stone was still performing and arranging in his 90s when he entered the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame 5 years ago. And yet, as far as I know, there has never been an album of strictly Jesse Stone's sides until now. Called Jesse Stone, alias Charles Chuck Calhoun, it begins with numbers that are unquestionably post-World War II swing and jump blues. It ends 11 years later in 1958 with tunes that are absolutely rock and roll. Stone's randy sensibility and touch with sleek, tough arrangements bridges the gap as well as anyone.
From style she sure ain't lacking, so how should I object? 'Cause when we start in smacking, her lips wrap all around my neck.
Check.
Hey, Sister Lucy, what makes your lips so juicy? Yes, I'd resist them if I could. Lord, I swear they sure are good.
If it's possible to be both elegant and off-color, Stone could do it. The hepcat rakishness of his 40s songs is very much in the mode of his old friend Louis Jordan. Who influenced who is hard to say. Best just to note that Jordan was a far stronger singer and sax player than Stone, but that Stone was his equal as a songwriter and a wit. Stone numbers like Keep Your Big Mouth Shut and Bling-a-ling-a-ling could be outtakes from Jordan at his most popular. Stone's attitude in his songs changes very little over the years, gets a bit more juvenile maybe, as befits the high school-obsessed 50s. But after he hooked up with Atlantic, he did gain his most crisp, inventive backup bands, with sax players like Hal Cornbread Singer and Sam the Man Taylor, along with guitarist Mickey Baker and other aces. These were the players with the smarts and licks to capture what Stone had heard Southern bands use to drive crowds wild. That is, new beats that were both more fluid and assertive than any rhythm and blues had been up to that time. Here's a Stone tune in the old swing mode.
Sneaky Pete.
Sneaky Pete
makes you jump for joy. Sneaky Pete.
Sneaky Pete. is the wrong McCoy. Sneaky Pete is the juice that seems so mild. After two drinks, it drives you wild. Sneaky Pete,
Sneaky Pete,
makes your ears go bop. Sneaky Pete,
Sneaky Pete,
helps you blow your top. Sneaky Pete is the jive that hits the spot. After one drink, your blood runs hot. Oh, it feels so good.
Here's a transitional number smack dab in the middle that was as close as Stone came to having a hit.
Smack dab in the middle, pitch a B. Smack dab in the middle, fling a me. Smack dab in the middle, and let me rock and roll to satisfy my soul.
And here's a near instrumental that's all the way into rock and roll. By the time this tune came out in 1958, enough of America had heard of this music to be having spasms about it. Full sound and ageless cool Stone developed in the early Atlantic sides provided inspiration for everything that came later, including Phil Spector, Motown, and the British Invasion. Jesse Stone was much more of a giant as a studio master and band preparer than he is as a performer. The CD Jesse Stone, alias Charles Chuck Calhoun, is probably only essential to confirmed fans of proto-rock and classic R&B, especially since it's an expensive German import. But I swear, half a dozen tracks on it will thrill anyone with a soul for the rest of their lives.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. He reviewed Jesse Stone, alias Charles Chuck Calhoun, on the Bear Family label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui Westman. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
My friend, let me put you wise. Keep yourself in trim. Don't neglect your exercise. If you want to stay slim and full of vim, you better get it while you can. Someday you'll be too old. And when you're old, you'll soon get cold. And when you're cold, your story's told. You can't make a move to save your soul. So get it while you can. You better get it while you can. Someday your bones will creak. And when they creak, you soon get weak. And when you're weak, you're up a creek.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yeah, when I get to Africa, we gonna get it on because we don't get alone. I will eat him up.
In 1974, Muhammad Ali and George Foreman met in Zaire for a World Heavyweight Championship bout. That fight is the subject of a new documentary called When We Were Kings. Two-time champion George Foreman will be our guest on the next archive edition of Fresh Air. Join us.